Welcome to Neighborhood Church. To learn more about who we are as a community or to financially support Neighborhood, go to neighborhoodchurchmn.org. Enjoy the message. So we are continuing our series, and it's called, I got to put it up there. All right. It's called, I love it. It's called What's the Deal? And you have to say it like that because it is inspired by one of my favorite comedians, Jerry Seinfeld. And Jerry Seinfeld made a whole career as a comedian by something called observational humor, where he would take things that we see or experience or consume every day or on a regular basis, but we don't really have language to put to the experience. So he would say, what's the deal with airline food, right? I nailed it, right? It's just exactly how it works. And it's true. It's like, why, when you go to the airport, why do you have to spend like $27 like on a chicken salad sandwich, right? And he has a whole bit on that. And it's funny because we experience and we're like, why do we just do that? And in our culture, in our society, and I'd even say in Christianity, there's things that we observe or we consume or that we experience, things that we do or don't do, laugh at, don't laugh at, spend money on or don't spend money on. And we don't always know why we do it or why we don't do it until it's like we did one a couple weeks ago before Good Friday of, it's like, what's the deal with all the blood in the gospel? Like, is God like just obsessed with blood? And how does something of a God killing his son or allowing his son, or whatever word you want to use, how is that like a good thing? It kind of goes against what we as parents, it's like, we're like, keep the kid alive. It's kind of like a big thing of parenting. And so why do we have this whole religion centered around blood and death? And is there other ways to think about it? Spoiler, there's a lot, right? But until you talk about it, because when I have the conversation with people, they're like, well, yeah, it's Good Friday. I'm like, what makes Good Friday so good? Blah, blah, blah. And they're like, well, I never thought about it that way. It's like, well, do we have permission to think about the things that question us, frustrate us, or cause us pain, or cause us joy? And so today, last week, Rebecca talked on the mysticism of what's the deal with prayer, right? And so today, we're obviously going to be talking about Jerbeau jeans, all right? Before we start, who owned a pair of Jerbeau jeans? Raise your hand. Raise it high like you're cool, all right? Who wanted a pair of Jerbeau jeans and never got them? I heard you, Melissa. Right. So we had three people raise their hands and three people who didn't. So we have those who are cool and those who aren't. Right? Well, here's this. If you don't know Jerbeau jeans, they were essentially in like the late 80s, early 90s, like designer jeans. Is that what we'd call them? All right. I imagine that many of us have the same story in 7th and 8th grade, that you just thought that you just weren't cool. And even though your mom or your dad tried telling you how cool you are, you're like, oh, you don't even know me, all right? And no matter how many people, all right, I had Mr. Rogers telling me how cool I was, all right, I had G.I. Joe telling me to believe in my dreams, I'm watching the More You Know commercials, I have all the Saved by the Bell, hello, all right, I have all these things telling me I'm a really good person, but I didn't believe it because I was in 7th and 8th grade. And when you're in junior high and you think you're not cool, the only way you become cool is something outside of yourself. For the longest time, I wanted a side spike. Mom, do you remember this phase in my life? I wanted a side spike because I have an afro, right? If you want to see my license picture, I'll show it to you. It's during COVID where I have so much hair, it goes out of the frame. Right, you don't know, you see where the hair begins, you don't see where it ends, and I have beautiful hair, right? But I didn't want beautiful hair because all these like ladies, I didn't know it at the time, wanted to come up and like, you have such beautiful hair, right? And not the kind of ladies I was really interested when I was 13, right? They were mostly like in their 60s and 70s, and but I thought it'd be cool if I had spiked hair like Michael Cockett, and if I had a cool shirt, if I could get something that would make me feel cool, that would put me in the place of being believed, I could be loved. I didn't have the language then, but now that I reflect, it's what I felt like. I didn't feel like I was believable. I did not feel like I was worth being included or listened to, let alone loved, let alone liked. But somehow I knew these jeans would make me the coolest person in the world. And so my parents gave all us siblings the same amount of money. Well, they told me they gave us the same amount of money. Probably gave Katrin more because you love her the most, obviously. And I hope Katrin's listening right now. So, jeans. I got. So then we got the same amount of money, and I went. I spent all my money on one pair of jeans, right? I don't remember. It was in the mall, at Millie Hill Mall. I don't remember where you bought Jabot jeans, but I bought them, and I instantly felt like I was just the God's given gift to seventh grade, all right? I'm like, the 45 people in my class are going to just drool over how cool I am. And it worked. I walked into school just like, what's up? What's up? Mr. Rosen, how are we doing? Don't like your class? Don't care if you give me detention. ISS, give me 3. I don't care, right? So you're walking around. The problem with spending all your money, and then it was $80. It was $80 for jeans, which in 1992 is the equivalent of $1.3 trillion today. All right? That's how the math works. And the problem with spending all your money, even though it worked, it made me feel alive, made me feel cool, is junior hires also have the ability of knowing when you wear the same pairs of jeans 5 days in a row. All right? So then I had to go to my backup, which was like Wranglers. All right? And not there's anything wrong with the Wranglers, but when you're in seventh grade, your dad brings home jeans that you can, like, cut tree branches off. They're so hard, right? It's funny you don't want to wear those. And because we're in a church, of course I'm going to make it about Jesus, all right? Jesus does the same thing. This is the ministry of Jesus, of walking around to people who think, I need something outside myself. I need something outside of myself. I need something outside of myself in order to be believed, loved, cool, holy, sacred, whatever it might be. Jesus is like, I got this wild thing that the beauty of you is already in you, because it is you. And we still want something outside of ourselves. And in the John chapter 5, which is, I feel like I say this every week, but it's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. It is probably the chapter I've preached out of the most, by far. And chapter 5, if you've ever been with a friend that has like an art degree, or they know a lot about music, or a lot about theater, or a lot about like a specific kind of movie, they will tell you things, usually at the most inconvenient times, but it's also really, really great. Like, I was with someone, and we're at art museum, and they're like, hey, it's a beautiful picture. It was by Van Gogh, and I don't remember what painting it was. But he said, now I want you to get really, really, really close. And so we got, like, as close as we could before security would do something. And he says, do you see behind the painting there's another painting? That Van Gogh couldn't afford another canvas, so he just reused canvas when he didn't like, he just paint over it. And you can see behind the painting another painting. And once you see it, you can't unsee it, right? Chapter 5 is like that. It is a pivotal part in the story of that John is sharing about Jesus. It's one of the 7 miracles that John highlights. And once you see it and you understand it, it changes how you think about God. It changes what you think about reality. And here Jesus is with his crew, and he's at this place called Bethesda, and it's this folklore. It is this mythical place, this mystical place, of where they believed that there was this angel that would be in this pool of water, and when it would move or it would stir, the water would be disrupted, it would begin to move, and they believed whoever got in there would have a miracle. So around this pool, you have people of all different kinds of abilities who are wanting to get into this water, and they stumble across this man who is losing his mind. He's not happy, and the way they reference him is called an invalid, right? Now, that word should bring up some emotion. It's a word we don't use, right? It's a word we don't, like, hey, what about, it is an emotionally charged word for a reason. And the translation, you can go several different ways. The NIV uses this word. And what it is meant to convey, it's a person who's laying by the pool, who can't move well, who relies on the assistance of other people. And you can imagine the living hell that this man is living in, because he wants to go by the pool amongst other people because there is this promise or this invitation or this opportunity that he could be normal, that he could be believed, that he could be included. He needed something outside of himself in order to be welcomed into his version of junior high. Yet, he can't get into that pool to be accepted, to be beautiful, to be quote-unquote normal, to be believed, to be sacred, because he needs other people. And the other people who might be there to help them probably want to go in themselves. And so he has this, I want to be like the beautiful people. I can be part of the beautiful people. I just have to get to those, like, what, 30, 40 feet, and no one will help him. So he's stuck in this world of other people telling him he's not worth anything, and then this folklore or this miracle or this other holy thing that is right next to him, he still can't even access. And Jesus sees it, he walks up to him, and he has the audacity to ask the question. And he says, it's John 5, I think, verse 6. He says, do you want to get well? Now, you could read, you could hear this in many different ways. For me, when I reread it this week, I read it as sarcastic. Like, do you want to get well? Like, trying to be funny to his brohams, right? Because this is what a lot of us do. We use sarcasm because we don't know how to talk about cancer. We don't know how to talk about diagnosis. We don't know how to talk about debt. We don't know how to talk about our family history. We don't know how to talk about a bad marriage. And so we don't know how to talk about our mental health. So we find different ways to try throwing a pebble of connection. We try some way so that the responsibility might be on someone else. That's why I read it first. Because it's almost like Jesus knows that this person is not great, but still asks. But another way of thinking about it, and this is the painting behind the painting, is Jesus says multiple times, if you see me, you see my Father. Paul Tillich said that we have this Jesus-looking God, right? That many other people have reinterpreted that. And so here in the gospel, we are seeing God dancing with humans. It's being played out in real time. You want to visualize, what is God really like? Here we have a picture. And it's a God that is asking for consent, which you don't always put those two together. We don't think about God and consent, because we think what we pray, oh God, will you please bring food to those hungry people? God, will you please rescue this demographic of people and lead them out? God, will you please heal my partner, heal my kid, please let my kid, whatever. We want God to drop something on someone else. We want God to drop something on us, because we think we need something outside of ourselves to be good. And so that's how we view miracles. And here is a God that goes to this person who has a clear need and asks them, what is it that you want? God doesn't drop things on us as much as God draws out of things that have always been in us. Right? And so when Jesus is saying, what is it that you want? He can see that the guy is hurting and the guy wants this healing. It's a consent. But Octavia Butler, who we talked about earlier, science fiction writer, at this conference I was just at, this poet got up and was talking about Octavia Butler and said that she wrote science fiction and she would create universes. She'd create completely different realities with different cognitive beings and species, and how they had problems, they had issues. How did they handle racism? How did they handle different ways of believing and ultimate reality? And when you have differences, like, and what she was doing is doing transformational work by telling a story, by telling a better story than maybe we could even tell ourselves. And what the poet said is, all transformation work is fictional. And it stuck with me. Because whatever we want for our kid, whatever we want for ourselves, whatever we want for our family, whatever we want for our neighborhood, our school, our country, it's fictional. Because it has not happened. And even if it's happened in the past, what it might be in the future is going to have a different energy, a different vibe. And so we dream, we long, we hope for something else. And this is what Jesus is doing. What story is it do you want to believe to be true? All transformational is fiction. Is dreaming of something new. And Jesus is asking this person, what is it you want? Another way of thinking about this, right? And if you've done, and I am no expert, and I've done like this much work on ableism theology, essentially, is this is revealing, not just back then, but us, about ableism. Of, hey, these people, you can sit around this pool and wish for something that may be true or not. We don't know, right? All that matters is they believed to be true, while everyone else kept on going about their day, contributing to society. Recently, we had someone, an unelected official, go on camera and have the audacity to say people with autism are less than human, essentially. You guys, you hear that? And then, one of the first things he said, like, they're never going to live a normal life because they're not going to be able to pay taxes, right? I didn't even listen to everything else. I read some things, and I'm, as the people in my life who I know who are on the spectrum, right? Like, I'm not getting into that, right? But when we live in a world where we have tiers of humans. And funny, the people that are like us, look like us, move like us, talk like us, spend like us, express racism like us, or tolerate racism like us, right? Whatever it might be, we put this into normal, and then we have subcategories beyond. And we've been doing this for forever, right? What Jesus is also saying to this person who's lived this, it's the only life he knows. We know that he's 30-something. Jesus, by asking, do you want to get well, is also a way of saying, do you believe that you were worth getting well? If you've been in poverty, if you have been, I have not. I have my own thing, but when you live in a hard, marginalized space, I imagine it's easy to believe what everyone else, the others, are telling you to be true. Jesus is separating it. Why, like, even the word disabled, why do we use that word? They're not disabled. They're differently abled. Why do we celebrate if you walk like this or you move like this, you can run like this, you can sit up, sleep, love, identify? Like, why are we saying this is healthy or normal and this is disabled? This is able, disabled. It's separating us versus them. And Jesus is saying, almost not just the man, but the people around him, do you believe this man is worth getting well? Does he deserve not just this miracle, but does he deserve to be loved or believed or heard or listened to, included? Oh, I love it. Because Jesus is telling this person, what is this fictional story that you want to move towards? And the rest of the story, Jesus heals and the guy gets up, and the end of chapter 5 is this wild story, which we'll get into a different time. But what I want for us is this. I'm a dreamer. It's like I live there. And there's seasons in my life, one recently, where those dreams just mute, right? And it was like the dark night of the soul, if you want to get really dramatic, right? And it was really, really hard. And I feel like recently I'm moving back in this place of dreaming, almost like the universe, almost like God is asking, like she's asking me, Chris, what is it that you want? Are we awake to be in touch with what it is that we want? Because when you're in tough spaces, when you're being pressed, it's not too hard sometimes. Like if you've ever gone without sleep, right? Right? If you've ever gone without sleep, it's like, what do you want? Anything that involves me closing my eyes for longer than 5 minutes, right? If you've been really thirsty, it's not hard to notice. If you're sad, it's not hard to notice. If you're happy and you are in this and the world is benevolent, it's easy to guess. But there's a lot of times we're unsure. So I want to give you 4 things, right, just to think through about dreams. When you're dreaming of what can be, whatever makes your heart go pitter-pat, pitter-pat, right? And that could be running a 5K. It could be speaking at a conference. It could be gaining 10 pounds. It could be reading all the works of Octavia Butler, whatever it might be. Wherever that dream is, and it can, regardless of how big or small it is, right? The first thing to do is recognize, where's the energy coming from? Where do you feel the love? And this, I love this one because I'm all vibes, all right? And I'm like, shoot first, ask questions later. That's how you know you're all vibes. You're like, it just feels right. Let's go. And so, but recognize that. And can you name it? Why does it feel so good? Why does it feel so true? Why is this idea, why is it like consumed? Why does it feel intoxicating to me? And if you can name it and you can draw that thread, it might lead to a teacher. It might lead to a book that you read or a movie or a song. It might be the at the gym, someone made a comment. Whatever it might be, what is fueling in a positive way? And equally, where do you feel the resistance? This is where most people start, is all the things you can't do, right? I could never go back and get my degree. I could never go and get into therapy. I could never run a 5K, and you can list all the things. well, have you named what those things are? Because the downside of being vibes only is when the vibes are bad, you're like, it must be impossible. Instead, this is why I love therapy. Herbert is my therapist, and I'll go in there, and I'm like, and I have all these feelings, and I cry for about a half hour. I pay people to watch me cry, all right? and I love it. I do. And I'll share all these feelings, and I always anticipate that he's going to look at me and do one of two things. Be like, who do you think you are? I always think he's going to shame me, right? That's really great for me. Or he's going to be like, you're just too much of a mess. It's time. Let's just wrap this up, right? And what he says when I have these strong emotions, and I look at him, I go through a lot of clinics, and he says, yeah, Chris, those are just your feelings. Feelings are good, but they're just feelings. Your brain is releasing this chemical into your body to get your attention. Are you listening? And if you can name, and he helps me name, I have this fear, I have this anger, I have this anxiety. And once I can name it, the power is way less, significantly less. I'm like, how did I give up 3 years of my life being afraid of that person? Because my body's saying, you're not safe, you're not safe. And you have to listen to that. But once I did the work of like, oh, that person has no power over me. Oh, I could bump into the grocery store, right? So what kept me safe and what I needed some time to distance doesn't have to be true for the rest of my life. And for some of us, it might be true for the rest of our life. But if you never take the time to identify and name, where am I feeling the love or the light? And what are these obstacles? And are they true? Are they coming from me, or are they legitimate things I need to make boundaries for? Third, I got to read this one. Oh, this is so good. If any of you who was any of my old Pentecostals, you might remember this, right? There was this thing where they'd do these crusades, and they'd bring in these speakers or these healers or these prophets or prophetess, right? Thank you for laughing. And they would have this whole song and dance, and it was really positive for a lot of people. And at the end of it, they'd say, who wants to give their life to Jesus? Who wants to ask Jesus into your heart with every eye closed and every heart open, right? Love that line. And they would do the sinner's prayer, the salvation prayer, whatever word you want to use. It's conversion is what it is. And I did this hundreds of times as a kid because I was so afraid of the devil like dancing over me like, oh, I got you. You didn't say it right. Ah! And so I would say this prayer over and over and over again. Even before I'd go on a flight as an adult, I'd say that prayer because I was so afraid. What if I didn't get it right? That's spiritual trauma. We'll leave that for a different time. But at the end of it, everyone would be having these good vibes, and they would say to the people, if you said this prayer, go tell someone. And I always found it interesting, like, why? Until I did it. And it felt so, even the theology and all of it behind, let's just put that aside, just the vibes. As a young kid and as a teenager, it felt so great to tell someone else and say, I felt, ooh, I'm surprised by this feeling. It's just a feeling, Chris. It's okay. It feels so good to tell someone I'm loved, right? There's something magical. There's something, you can even use the word supernatural, of when you put words to what you experience or what you believe to be true, right? So they knew this. So they'd say, and imagine there's some psychology behind it, right? And they'd say, go tell someone. And if you have a dream and you're like, hey, I've done the work with the light and the love and the obstacles, and you have this dream, tell someone. Tell, regardless if you think how big or small it is. Like I said, a 5K. I remember training for my first 5K, and I ran a half mile without stopping, and I thought like I was Superman, right? And I want to tell everyone, but I'm like, oh, it's just a half mile, and it didn't stop. It's not that big of a deal. It is a huge deal, right? If it's you're trying to put on 10 pounds and you put on 3, like tell someone, right? But here's the problem. Why do we not want to tell people? Someone want to say it? Why are we afraid of telling people our dreams? Judgment for what? Because you didn't do it. So we're aware of a fictional reality, And in our heads, we already believe the fictional, the future reality is that we're a loser or we're a failure. So we self-protect by not telling it. And by not telling it, we go back into the cycle of like, I'm nobody. This is just the best it's going to be. I'll always just be this. And even though it's something in our heart, there's like that, right? That little canary is singing this song that there might be a future, a life better than here right now. And we don't want to tell anyone. For me, I'm an alcoholic. I've been in recovery for 11 months, right? And I didn't want to tell anyone that I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to tell myself I was an alcoholic. And I, because it's like, well, then I have to, well, either I have to do something about it or I just continue to kill myself slowly, right? And so I still remember the first time I said out loud to myself was at my sister's cabin, and I was on a what I call a not-so-silent retreat because I like the idea of a silent retreat, but I like to talk and listen to music, right? So, and I finally said it out loud to myself, and all I said was like, what am I so afraid of not drinking? Before it was like, can I live without it? How, blah, blah, all the things. But when I put it out of like, what am I so afraid of? And then it gave me the courage to tell myself, and it gave me this, and it's not, it's a beautiful story. It's filled with pain. If you know anything, recovery stories, right? But then to tell the people I love most, and that set me of where I'm at today. And regardless of where you're at in that spectrum of, I want to tell someone, do it. If you fail, it's still a part of your story. It's still a part of you. And your worth is not dependent on how many of the things I said out loud did I actually accomplish. That is a capitalistic society where we value their people's values based on what they produce. That is a bunch of garbage. It never gets us anywhere. Instead of being in a place where you feel it's safe enough to say the things that you love and you want to try, even if you'd never move towards it. So, follow the energy, name the obstacles, say it out loud, and last one, which I crossed the two, is celebrate, what did I write it? I learned this from my wife. Celebrate incremental growth, right? If you're trying to run if you run a half mile without stopping, celebrate it. Just don't wait until you finish the half marathon. If you feel like I'm trying, like a goal for me, I'm saying it out loud, a couple years back was like, I want to be kind. I don't think I'm super kind. I want to be known as a person that's kind, not just funny or sarcastic or brilliant. That was number one, right? I want to be kind. And I would celebrate with myself when I felt like, oh, I should have said that joke. Instead, I said, wow, that's really great, right? Celebrate incremental growth. And so here's where I end before I pray. This is a quote from Octavia Butler's book, The Parable of the Sower, I think. Yeah, Parable of the Sower. It's short. I'm going to read it twice. And if you feel comfortable, I'm going to encourage you to close your eyes, and not as a magic trick, but as a way of just like centering all your energy into what you are feeling and maybe what your body's telling you, or maybe even what you might believe God is inviting you into. And as you hear this, I'd like you to center maybe one of the dreams that are floating around in your existence. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. All that you touch, you change. And all that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. So, Sacred Mother, we celebrate you. Spirit, we invite you. And the eternal cosmic Christ, we center you. And thank you for the stories we see in John of people being transformed by the kindness and love and the majesty of Christ. Thank you for the fictional stories of these authors who are giving us dreams of a future reality that doesn't have to take place in another world or another life or another person, but can be right here, right now. And Spirit, give us the wisdom and moxie to hear, identify, but also believe that we are worth being well. And I say to my friends who maybe in some version have been like the person by the pool who's believed this is all it's ever going to be. And what we want, God, is to move towards those dreams. So we love you. In your name, amen. All right. So thank you for being in this space. If you'd like to process, you'd like to talk, you'd like to chat, you'd like to pray, I would love nothing more than to do that with you. As you heard, our kids are up here right now, right? Which I love. So feel free to stick around as long as you'd like and enjoy the rest of your weekend.